This is the Lansing Fisher-Body Historical Team. We're at the Frank Dreyer House across the street from the UAW Local 602 Hall on Michigan Avenue. It is January 26, 2006, and it's approximately 9:30 a.m. We are preparing to interview Gerald Taylor. First, let's state the names of the rest of the people in the room.
Mike Fleming.
Marilyn Coulter.
John Fedewa.
And this is Cheryl McCoy. Gerald Taylor, could you state your name and spell your last name for us, please?
Yes, my name is Gerald Taylor, T-A-Y-L-O-R.
Your address?
2775 North Stein in Charlotte, Michigan.
Are you married?
Yes.
Do you have children?
Yes, three.
Where were you born?
I was born in Ionia, but raised in Charlotte.
Could you give us a little bit on your educational background?
56 years of hard knocks, 12 years of high school, a year and a half of college.
What did you go to college for?
Well, I started out to go for accounting, but halfway through my classes, I went up to the offices in Charlotte, or in Fisher-Body, and told them I was going to accounting class, what would be my chances of getting into payroll, working up there. And I was told by the gentleman in charge that I wasn't black, I wasn't Mexican, I wasn't a female, I didn't have a snowball's chance in hell. Right straight out. That's what he told me, so I said fine and went right back to the line.
So what did you end up going to college for?
It was accounting. I had a year and a half of accounting. That's what I took.
And what did your parents do?
My mother worked at a men's clothing store in Charlotte, and my father hauled milk. Went around the farms, picked up milk. Then he was a trustee at the county jail.
And did you spend any time in the military?
Yes. I was a reservist from 1967 to 73. I was in the Navy Reserve. I did 14 months active duty in Vietnam.
And why did you hire into Fisher-Body? Did you know about Fisher-Body before you put in an application?
My father-in-law worked at Fisher-Body, and I had a brother-in-law that worked at Fisher-Body. He recommended I come over and put my name in.
And that was right there at the plant, or was that at Michigan?
It was right at the plant. Right on. That's when you went into the plant and talked to guys in there. Tommy, can't remember his last name. I want to say Burns. I don't know if that's right or not. It was the guy I talked to.
Did you have to stand in line to put in application?
No. There wasn't no standing in line. They wanted bodies.
And how long did it take you to get into the plant?
Well, I come in on a Wednesday, and they want to know if I want to go to work that night. And I told them that I had another employer that I felt I should give notice to. I was working at a cabinet shop at the time. And told them I thought I should give him 2 weeks' notice. And they said, okay, fine. So they said, we're not going to give you 2 weeks, but we'll give you till the end of next week. So about 10 days after that, I hired in here and started in here the 8th of April.
Do you remember the first day you walked into Fisher-Body and where they took you, what job you did?
They took me right to the paint department. Can I tell you a little story about this?
Oh, please. Want
to hear something good?
Yes.
Like I said, my father hauled milk, and it was over west of Lansing, Ingham County. We hauled milk, and we had one guy that we'd go to pick up his milk. His name was John Griffies, and he had a driveway about as wide as this table. And trying to back a truck up in a driveway this wide, you're going to get on somebody's grass. And I got on his lawn, and he come out of the house and just chewing me out, and I said, why don't you bite it? And he turned around and went back in the house. I loaded up the milk and left. The next day, I hired in Fisher-Body. This was on a Sunday. Following Monday, I hired in Fisher-Body. They took me to the paint department. They took me out to see my foreman. My foreman was John Griffiths.
Oh.
And they said, this is Jerry Taylor. And John says, yeah, I know him, and he knows me. My name's Bite It. So I didn't think I was going to last at Fisher-Body very long. But John was a good guy. He let me go, and I hired in Fisher-Body.
And what job did John put you on?
When I first come in, they put me to spraying, what do they call it? Underbody. I was spraying underbody. Out in the paint department.
Was that a hard job?
Yes.
What was hard about it?
Well, you were in a pit, and you had to wear a hood, and you had this wand, And as the cars were coming down at an angle from above you, from upstairs, you had to spray the underbody with that. And that was one dirty, messy job. And that's pretty, when you went in the paint department, that's where you started at that time. It was pretty much in that job.
How long did you do that, Jeff?
3 weeks.
3 weeks?
Yep. Then I went to spray in lacquer. They had an opening, and I went in to spray lacquer from there.
And that was the job you requested, or?
No. At the time, they just asked me if I wanted to spray lacquer. I said, sure. You got it. Back when I hired in here, and I think it was a little worse even before I hired in, but if you, the physical they give you was if you could bend over and touch your toes and come up breathing, you were hired. And the first thing they would ask you is, you got a buddy looking for work? I hired in with a guy, in fact, a pair of brothers, Aiken brothers. They were twin brothers. And the one brother didn't like it here. Didn't like the job they put him on, so he quit. Went over to Oldsmobile. Got hired in. Didn't like the job they put him on. Come back over here. He quit over to Olds. Come back over here. Didn't like the job they put him on. Quit. Went back over to Olds. The third time back here, they finally put him on a job he liked, and he stayed here. I mean, this area was screaming for people. They were screaming for bodies. Wow. Nobody wanted to work in the shop back then. That was when I hired in here, being used to being outdoors, growing up hauling milk and doing that kind of stuff, being cooped up in a shop was hard for me. First 5 years I worked here, I had a rough time staying here. I mean, if they come up and says they've got extra help, you want to go home, they only had to ask me once. I was out of here. I hated it in here. I hated being cooped up.
How old were you when you hired into Fish Fry?
18.
18. What shift?
Well, like I said, I hired in on day shift because once I got into lacquer booths, I didn't know it, but the guy I was doing underneath, I thought it was my job, but I found out that I was put on utility when I got here. So they took me everywhere. I did nothing but fill sick leaves. I didn't have a regular job. I just filled sick leave spots. I went from spraying deadener underneath to spraying lacquer in the booth to spraying undercoat to spraying deadener upstairs to hanging paper to working on the sealer line. I think I was in here 6 months before I actually had a job that was mine. It was my own job.
Did you like doing the sick leave replacement job or did you like having your own job?
Well, the one thing I liked about it, I hired in April 8th. July 8th was when we were going down for changeover. Anybody that didn't have their 90 days in, they'd lay off. And if you got laid off and then brought back after changeover, they'd readjust your seniority date. So you actually would lose time. Because I was covering sick leaves, they couldn't lay me off. So I got my 90 days in the day we went down for changeover. So I got my 90 days where a lot of guys got messed over. By doing these replacements, I was able to get my 90 days in a stay.
My uncle, Jerry, can you explain what a changeover is?
It's when we would go down to change body style. We may be down a week. We may be down 2 weeks. I've seen it last as much as 7 weeks that we would be down while they were doing a body change. Changing the dies, bringing the parts in, getting the body shop set up. So, I mean, there was, at that point, that's what we called a changeover, because there was a major changeover done inside the shop. You were pulling all the stock out, bringing all the stock back in again, resetting jobs. So it was a major change at that time.
Mike Fleming, Jerry.
Yeah, Mike.
When you came in, you talked about the different places you worked. You went into the paint department. Was looking at that amount of people and that big of a structure, was that kind of, what did that feel like for you when you walked in there?
It was something all new to me because I'd been in a cabinet shop where there were 6 employees. I mean, that was it. And so walking into here and seeing the amount of people that was here was something all new to me. And it was something that I had a rough time adjusting to. But once I adjusted to it, I actually, after 5 years, I got to where I enjoyed it in there. Crazy to say, but I enjoyed coming in here. You get to know the people, you get to get friends in here, and it makes it a lot easier to come in. And this place was a very friendly place to work. It was enjoyable.
Cheryl McQuaid, how did you learn the job that they gave you, all of these sick leave jobs? Who taught you these jobs?
They had,
you tell me a little about the process?
They had people that break in. They had utility people that would break in, or intermittent relief man that would break in. And they normally, at that time, you had 3 days to break in on a job.
And was there a good way to learn the job or a bad way to learn the job?
Normally what you would do is watch the other individual do it. You'd do it his way and then adjust it to where it was easier for you. You'd learn it his way so that you could do it, and then you'd adjust it to your way to make it easier to you, because no two people would normally do the job the same way.
Can you tell me a little bit about the people that you hired in around, some of the things that went on during work hours that made it interesting, made it...
When I hired in, like I said, I hired in the paint department, and there was a lot of women in the paint department at that time. There wasn't in trim at that time. Trim was pretty much all male. Body shop was all male. The women were either in what was left of the cushion room, which there wasn't much of it at that time, or they'd come out of the cushion room and they'd come down in the paint department. They either ran sealer guns or hung paper, because at that point we ran two tones, and you had to tape the car off, you know, if you were doing a two-tone job. So you got to know a lot of the people there. And some of the women in there were ornerier than the day was long, but some of them were some of the sweetest people you'd ever want to meet. And I was kind of a guy that never really accused me of being wrapped too tight as it was. And I would have some fun with some of those ladies in there. They were just great. I said my father-in-law got me hired in there, but he actually wasn't my father-in-law at the time. I was engaged to his daughter, and I worked with a gal in the sealer section. Her name was Mavette Pointer, and she was the nosiest lady the good Lord ever put on this work. She was a sweetheart, but she was just nosier, and the day was long, and a busybody like you wouldn't believe. And she kept asking me about the wedding, and I told her, I said, I'm sorry, I can't tell you about the wedding. And that just set her right on tilt. And she said, why not? I said, well, I promised my father-in-law that I wouldn't talk to anybody about the wedding, because my father-in-law was a relief man for the painters in the booth. His name was Charlie Grimwood. And so finally she kept bugging me. I said, okay, I'll tell you. But you got to promise not to tell anybody else. She said, okay, I won't tell a soul. And I thought to myself, yeah, right. So I said, well, the reason, I said, Charlie said the only way I could marry his daughter is if we had a nudist wedding. So it wasn't 5 minutes later, she went on relief. And she was gone like a jackrabbit, out in the sealer line, up one side and down the other, telling everybody. About 2 hours later, my father-in-law comes out and says, what the hell are you telling everybody? I said, what? He says, what's the shit you're telling everybody? I'm having a nudist wedding. And I just started laughing. And she says, yeah, I can keep a secret, but there wasn't anybody in that paint department didn't know what was going on. That's the kind of stunts I pull here and there, just to have fun. Great
so,
folks.
Do you remember any other pranks or?
Yeah,
could
one
you
or two.
Share with us.
Okay, there was a gentleman named John McNish that was a great guy, and he had one of the sweetest voices. I mean, for a singer, he should have been a professional singer, because his voice was just unbelievable. And he would work in the booth and sing and everything else. Well, if he thought there was somebody new coming in, he had a little trick that he'd pull on everybody. Well, what John didn't know was I hired in on days, and I was on nights at this time. I hired in on days, and I spent most of my first 9 months there on days, or 10 months, because right after that, I went in the service. And when I come back in the service, I went back into nights in the paint department. Well, John wore coveralls, but he wore nothing underneath his coveralls. And he's what you'd call a very well-endowed individual. So he would rip his coveralls open, haul his member out, and go chasing after the new guy in the booth just to see what had happened. Well, I just wasn't the kind of guy that you chased. So I just stood there with my paint gun, and when he come up, I painted him from one end to the other. And he stopped right dead in his tracks, looked at me, and says, you wasn't supposed to do that. I said, well, sorry. He come in about an hour and a half later, and he says, tears were just running down his eyes, and he says, you know what hot thinner does to a person trying to take pain off? He says, you're not a nice man. Turned around and walked away. But we got to be good friends, and he was just a fantastic guy. It just, all kinds of stuff going on in there. Just, it was kind of a crazy time. You had to be a little crazy to work in there. It helped. at the time, but the people were out of this world. Very seldom. You had a difficulty with anybody in there at the time. It just, everybody was kind of one big happy family in there. It was enjoyable to work.
Mike Fleming, Jerry, while you're on this subject, just very, very quickly, can you talk about some of the health and safety strides that you had seen gained since you came in then and when you left, as far as, you know, the paint and the fumes and the personal protective equipment you had to have?
Well, the paint at that time was not that big a problem. It was a lacquer that kind of hung to you, and they you had breathing apparatus you could wear if you wanted them. Most guys didn't wear them because they didn't figure it was that bad. There was good airflow in the booths. They had a watershed on the side that would actually help attract the paint dust to it. It wasn't that bad. As far as health and safety, it's something I really, when I first hired in there, it's not something I even was concerned with. It didn't seem to be a problem, and I never really heard that much talked about it. Towards the later part, yeah, it was.
Jerry, mine's back to the man who chased you and you painted. Now, you said there were a lot of women in the paint department.
Right.
Were there women in the lacquer booth?
No.
When he was chasing people?
No.
So it was just men in there.
Right.
And that was a joke.
When you went in the lacquer booths, the doors were closed. There's a door that swung closed. And you could see guys in there, maybe from the shoulders up and like that. But you really couldn't see what was going on. It was kind of its own little entity in there. And that was to keep it restricted for airflow and everything else. So
in the paint department, they had the different booths and people could... So there wasn't, was it hard to communicate up there outside of that?
No.
I mean, did lacquer people basically stay with lacquer people and sealer people basically stay with sealer people? Or did everybody
pretty much,
get
yeah,
out?
Because it was all split up. I mean, you had a section that was called the sealer room.
Mm-hmm.
Then you had the area out. There had some windows we could look out in the parking lot like that. Actually, it's where the old trim shop, the A-Trim was
mm-hmm.
that point. But there was a place where they hung paper, where they sealed off the doorpost. I mean, they'd tape that off because you two-toned. So if it was a two-tone car, you had to tape off. There was frames around the windows at the time. So you had to make sure you tape those frames off. You know, they were one color, then it was being done for the other. So, but yeah, I mean, there was different places that you were at. It was all paint department, but it was spread over quite a large area in there. So yeah, you were in different segments of it. You knew people
mm-hmm.
from all over because people moved back and forth. But yeah, it was
mm-hmm.
it was pretty much compartmentized as far as who you worked with.
So do you have any other funny stories?
A couple. We were there on days spraying lacquer. Gosh, I can't remember. It's probably, I've been there about 4 years, I think. And the power went out. And that building was dark as a coal mine. You couldn't see. You come out of the lacquer booths, there was doors that come out of the lacquer booths into this main aisleway that come down. And so you had to feel your way to a door, open the door, go out in the main aisleway. Then you could see a little light where the windows were at the end where they masked off. So you walk towards the light. And I heard this one guy running, and I heard a guy open the door. And he ran right into that door. And there was about four guys knocked out cold, laying. They were getting walked on, laying between the two booths where they'd been hit by a door where they come running out of there when the power went out. And they... there was one supervisor with a flashlight that was trying to go back in and bring these guys around to get them out of there because they were evacuating the plant because all the power was gone. A couple of gals that were hanging paper, one gal started screaming because somebody had a hold of her. And it was crazy. I mean, it was chaos in there. You know, it was comical. You were a little bewildered about what was going on, but you couldn't help but laugh because you're hearing these guys getting knocked out, running down between the booths. You hear this gal screaming out there saying she's being molested, and everybody else just trying to look for a way out of there. So it was about 20 minutes of chaos, but looking back on now, it was one of the funniest times I ever seen in there.
Do you know, I'm sorry, Cheryl McCoy, do you know why the power was out? Approximately what year that was?
I'm going to say 71, 72, somewhere in there. It was a squirrel went into one of the main transformers out here in the power section. Got in the main transformer and blew it out.
Oh.
It had knocked out all the power in our end of the plant. And even the safety lights they had hanging up, I don't know where they were aimed, but they didn't do anybody any good because you couldn't see anything. All you could see was the windows. And once you found your way to the windows, then you could walk around the wall and go out through the paint mix room and get outside.
Mike Fleming, Jerry. You spoke about the lights going out and someone being walked over and the foreman with the flashlight. As you were in the paint department, did you experience any fatalities or any really serious accidents up there while you were there?
Not in the paint department. No.
Are you aware of any in the plant?
There was one skilled tradesperson, if I remember right, it was in the body shop, and I can't say for sure when this was, but I'm sure it's while I was still in paint, that was working on the track, and one of the dogs broke loose, the car come through and hit him, and I believe it killed him, but it's been so long ago, I can't remember for sure, but I know, and I'm sure it's while I was in paint, that there was a tradesman who was killed when a car hit him, coming down, there was an incline, and he was working on the track itself, and the car broke loose from the dog and come down and hit him in the head. And I think he had the head injuries, and I think eventually he died from it.
Could you explain what a dog is?
As the cars come down the line on a chain, there was brackets that actually caught the car. They were called dogs that moved the car, wouldn't let it go forward or backward. It kept pretty much in place. It was going down the line. So that's what I meant by dog.
Jerry, did you spend all of your time in the paint department?
No. After 5 years, I put a transfer in for trim. We were working a lot of Saturday nights, and I'd ask my supervisor, I was spraying deadener up in the deadener booth at that time, to go home that night because I had a family function. And he says, yeah, come on in, help us get started, and I'll let you go. So I come in. And we started at 4 in the afternoon at that time. And I come in at 4, and he was supposed to have me out of there by 5:30. Well, at 5:15, he come walking back, and I asked him where my replacement was. And he says, you don't have one. You got to stay. And I told him I wasn't staying. I said, at 5:30, I'm out of here. And Joe come back, and he says, I ain't got anybody. And I said, well, you better learn how to spray deadener then, because I told you, 5:30, I'm out of here. And he says, that means you quit. I says, no, I'm way out. I'm going to knock you on your ass. You're going to fire me before I leave. And he said, you wouldn't. And I said, 5:30, you're going to find out. At 5:30, I started walking out of the booth, and I was heading right for Joe. And just as I got to him and grabbed his shirt, he says, there'll be a guy up here in 5 minutes. Take your place. I said, okay. So I went back in the booth for 5 more minutes, and he got a guy up there, and I went home. But as I was leaving, he told me I reported to trim on Monday. My transfer had been approved. So I all of a sudden wound up in trim department.
What kind of jobs were in the trim department?
The first job I had in trim was building and installing taillights. And that was a good job. I enjoyed that job. And let's see. Gosh, I'm trying to think of all the jobs I've had. There have been a lot of jobs over the years.
Could you explain maybe what the climate, what the atmosphere was in the paint shop compared to the trim department?
It was the same. Once you got in and had a group of guys in your area and different guys that you met, you know, that you knew through the plant, once you got to be friends with them, it was the same. I mean, there was camaraderie all through the plant. Always frogging around, always something going on. People just... Like I said, you had to be crazy to keep your sanity in there, in a way. And I worked with a couple of guys who were characters. John Arnest was one, and another guy named Ed Weber we called Chopper. And he was definitely a couple sandwiches shy of a full picnic basket.
Called him Chopper. Why is Chopper?
I don't know why. That's a nickname he always had. And he was crazy. But fun. We sure had a good time there. I mean, we just acted crazy to keep our sanity. Because, I mean, day after day, that's back when we were working 5 or 6 days a week. When I first hired in here, the first day I hired in, we worked 10-4. The next day I worked there, it was 11-3. If women worked on the line, see, there at that time, there was a state law that a woman couldn't work more than 8 hours. So they would send one line home early and take guys off of one line, put over on the other line, covering the women so they could go home.
I'm sorry, could you explain to me what is 10-3 and 11-4?
10.3 hours.
10.3
right.
hours.
Right. Each tenth was 6 minutes. So you worked 10 hours and 18 minutes. Or 11.2. I mean, and I first week I worked here, I kind of thought maybe I made a bad mistake because that got to be some long hours. But yeah, there's time. There's one line we work 11-2. If you worked 9-4, that was considered a short day. Back then, we worked some crazy hours. And for a while, I even worked paint repair when I was on utility and on day shift. And we would come in at 5 in the morning and leave here 7:30, 8 o'clock at night. Night shift would come in at 5 at night, and they'd still be working with us for a couple hours in the morning, just trying to get cars caught up. They had a horseshoe up in paint repair, and cars would go around that horseshoe, and you may paint the same car 4 times because they'll find spots that need to fix them.
Mike Fleming, Jerry, when you talked about the 10-4 and 11-2, I don't think average people understand that when you work on a line like that, that you are bound and never know what time you're going to leave. Right. And that was one of the things that's probably the biggest awakening, is that you never know when you're going to go home.
Right.
And you can't leave until they say that you're
going
to leave.
That's right. I mean, you would get a call normally around 7 hours. After you've been working 7 hours, they'd call and let you know what line time was going to be. And if they called 8 hours, you would hear cheering from one end of that plant to the other, because that was a very, very seldom you worked 8 hours. It was always, and like I said, 9-4 was considered a short day. I may work all day spraying lacquer, come out of one booth, they'll work the line, like I said, 8 hours. Because by then, I mean, the word was women could not work over 8 hours at that time. And when the law was changed, when the equal rights first started, and there was a couple women in the plant at that time. One gal's name was, I can't think of her name. I can see her plain as day, but I can't think of her name. But she was a women's liber, you know, and she said that she should have the right to work any job a man does and do anything a man should have to do. And we worked across from one another, and she was starting to give me her spiel, and we kind of got into an argument. I said, listen, I said, don't tell me you're the same as I am. You're not. You're not the same as me. You're not equal to me. I'm not equal to you. But I said, where I agree with you is, I do not think there is a woman that should not have a chance to do what she feels she can do. There's things that you can do that I can't do. There's things that I can do that you can't do. So don't say we're equal. But I think you should have an equal obligation or an equal chance to do anything you feel you've got the right to do or want to try and do. After that, her and I got along good. But I mean, she gave me her point of view, but I gave her mine. And we got along good after that. But when the law finally went through, she worked every bit of overtime she could work. But a lot of the women in that plant were madder than hell when that law was passed, because they liked getting out at 8 hours. They like pointing their fingers at the guy and kind of snickering and walking out of the plant when they knew they was going to be there another 3 hours. Now make some happy campers in there. So when that law was changed, the guys were cheering. The women weren't happy about it. There's a lot of them that weren't. The older ones. The younger ones didn't mind it, but the older ones weren't happy about it at all. And a lot of them retired.
Marilyn Coulter.
Jerry, when you got transferred down into trim, were there a lot of women down in trim as like there was up in paint?
I'd say no. It wasn't until 70, they had a hiring in 77. That's when you started seeing the women come into the actual trim department. There were some in there, but not very many. Majority of them, like I said, were paper hangers and like that down in paint. You didn't see very many women.
Okay, when you saw them in 77, when the women started coming into the plant, did you notice any changes? How did the men feel about women coming into trim shop?
There's some that were not happy about it at all. And they made no bones about it. You know, my attitude was the same as Liz was the gal's name. Liz, and I think her last name was Ward. But I told Liz when we talked, and I had that same attitude. Mm-hmm. If they brought a gal in, the gal says she can do that job, as far as I'm concerned, she should have the right to try and do that job, you know. Let her prove she can or can't, but don't say she can do it without giving her a chance. You know, that has always been my feelings on it. And so there was a lot of guys that they had to change their ways. Their Playboy pinups that were on the lockers and everything else all had to come down. Some didn't take them down, but or they moved them inside the door rather than outside. But it did change things. But it became a different place to work. In a way, it was the same, but in a way, it was a different place to work, too.
Were there any other kind of changes that you noticed? Like, they had pinups? Did they have to add more bathrooms? What kind of the things
the bathrooms, yeah. We had one long changeover. I can't remember the year of it now. It seems like it was 78. It may have been, yeah, I believe it was 78. We had a long changeover because they did have to add, I think, three women's bathrooms into the plant at that time. They did not have the facilities. There was no, locker rooms, you know, places. They put a new paint room in 84, and there was a women's locker room put in. Before that, I don't think there was a women's locker room either because the locker room down is pretty much all male. I mean, the showers is one big open shower that you just, you know, walked into, took your shower, got dressed, and went home. So that definitely, the facilities had to change for what they were doing.
Jerry, how did you get back and forth to work?
Well, I used to drive, and then when they come up with this thing about carpooling, I started riding in carpool and eventually was in a van pool. But I had to get out of it because being a committeeman at the time, I was a committeeman in 84, and there's no way I wanted the guys to wait for me while I was doing paperwork at the end of the shift. So I started driving by myself, and I pretty much drove by myself ever since because I've been on one union job or another. And rather than tie somebody up, I just drove.
Can you tell me a little bit? You lived in Charlotte, right?
Yes.
What was it like riding back and forth with people? Did you like it?
Oh, yeah. It was fun. I had a couple guys I rode with. They were good guys. One of them I went to school with. I've known him for years, him and his brothers. And the other guy was a guy I'd met in there and worked with. So, yeah, we had a good time. It was a lot of fun. The only difference is they like to stop and get some encouragement on the way home. And I give that up. When I come home from service, I was an alcoholic, and I walked away from it and didn't touch a drop for almost 35 years. So that's one reason why I quit riding with them and went into the van pool, was because I wasn't drinking anymore. I flat quit. I just walked away from it and quit and did it for, well, it's been... For 35 years, I never touched a drop, and now if I drink, I will have no more than one beer or one mixed drink, because I can still remember what it was like in the old days, so I just won't do it. So, and that's why I went to a van pool, to get away from the drinking those two guys were doing.
And so the van pool, they didn't stop for encouragement?
No. We may stop for pop on the way home, something like that, but we didn't drink in the van pool.
And when you rode with other people, did you just chip in for gas? Was there a standard?
We take every third day you drive when I was in there. And when I was in van pool, you paid him so much a week. I can't remember sure what it was. I think it was $20 paid for the week to ride or something like that. But when I rode with a couple other guys, just every third day you drove. That's the way we had it worked out.
So when you first hired into the plant, speaking of how much it costs for the gas and everything, what kind of wages were you looking at?
Well, when I first hired in, I hired in at $2 and, or no, I take it back. I think it was $3. I'm going to say $3.34 an hour. And that was $1.60 more than I was making as the head cabinet builder at a cabinet shop. The first week I worked there, I took home three times the money. I took home 1 week in a cabinet shop.
And that was as the head cabinet maker.
Yes. So it was a big change. And the benefits. That's another reason why I went to General Motors to begin with. Is I planned on getting married. I planned on having a family. And I looked at the benefits. And that's something I never really thought about until I talked to my father-in-law, who did work in here, or soon-to-be father-in-law, who did work in here. And that's a point he brought up that I hadn't thought about. But I'm glad he did now, because it has made a difference over the years, knowing that I've had that security for my family.
Marilyn Coulter.
Jerry, we know how you got to work now and some of the things you did at work. Well, what did you do for lunch and breaks and things like that? What did the areas do?
They used to have what they call a wagon that come through there. And it had milk, sometimes pop, donuts, Hostess wrap stuff in it, different things. That when you had your wagons, and I can't remember when we lost those. Seems like it was about 84. Maybe it was before that we lost them, but you had a wagon in the morning, a wagon in the afternoon, where they stopped the line for, I think it was 7 minutes, 6 minutes or 7 minutes, and that was your wagon. And most guys brought their lunch. A lot of guys would go to Harry's across the street and drink their lunch. There's a bunch that did that. Cafeteria. Some went up there. But the majority of guys that I worked with at that time brought their lunches with them. If they ate lunch at all, they brought them with them.
And now Harry's, I was taking it was a tavern.
Yes.
Was there food there?
Food, mostly burgers. You know, you get your burgers or hot dogs, fries, and they had beer and whatever. So guys would go over there. Like I said, some would go over there and drink their lunch. I had one guy I used to ride back and forth to work with for a while. Mike Davids was his name. And he was about as big around as a pencil. We would stop on the way into work, and he would eat two Whoppers and fries and have a shake before we got to work. He would eat his lunch before first wagon got there. He'd eat a wagon. He'd eat lunch. He'd eat a second wagon. And he'd stop on the way home and eat a burger. And then when he got home, before he went to bed, he'd open one of those big cans of Denny Moore beef stew and eat it before he went to bed. And this guy didn't weigh 110 pounds soaking wet. He was a character.
Mike Fleming, Jerry, you were talking about going over to Harry's Payday.
Right.
Was it pretty popular there?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Harry's would cash your check. He had a place in the back where you'd go up and cash your check. I never did over there, but I know there's a lot of guys who did. And times I went over there and grabbed a burger for lunch, I see guys still going over there. Yeah, that was a regular enterprise there. I don't know if he charged you for cashing the check, if there was, you know, what kind of a deal he had for that. But I know he had a regular little booth in the back where he set up and cashed checks. In all the years that he did that, I was never, could never understand why nobody tried robbing them. But I don't think of it was ever robbed that I can remember. But why it wasn't, it's always been beyond me.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
So, speaking of checks and breaks and stuff like that, did you get involved in things, like, did they have, like, check pools, football pools, and what were
those? Oh, that's been an ongoing thing in there. There was one guy in there that was a regular loan shark. And finally, a couple guys caught him outside the plant and readjusted his attitude on being a loan shark. That went on, and then that was about 79 or 80 that happened. Mm-hmm. But, oh, yeah, there was always check pools going on in there. There's always, especially at football game, football time, there's always football pools going on mm-hmm. all through trim. Once in a while, basketball, there'd be some kind of a pool or some setup going with it. Mm-hmm. Holiday time, there's always something going on. So, yeah, that was part of the camaraderie, I think, you know, getting the thing going on. Some departments would have it, some wouldn't. Mm-hmm. You know, you get somebody like to do it, he'd take the time to do it, other ones wouldn't. Mm-hmm. But you get that, dinner's going on. Somebody just out of a whim would say, hey, let's do an area dinner. So somebody would come up and down the line, well, this person's bringing this person's bringing this, what do you want to bring? Mm-hmm. And they bring it. Holiday time, it was a given. I mean, you knew you were going to have some dinner somewhere. It may be A-trim or it may be Area 10. Each area is divided by 10, 20, 30, whatever. And Area 10 may be putting on a dinner. Area 20 may not. Area 30 may be putting one on. So they'd go into Area 20 and say, well, we're having one here. So you join one or the other. So there was always dinners going on. Always benefits going on of some type. There was always raffles. Guys would be going through raffling off things for their kids. I mean, I don't know how many fathers come in and were selling stuff for the kids or raffling for their kids' programs. If somebody was hurt, there was always collections being taken up. And I don't ever remember a time where I ever saw a person refuse to put in on a collection for somebody, be it their spouse died, parent died, child died, whatever. There was always a collection taken up. Like I said, this place back up until in my opinion, until it got taken over by Oldsmobile. Back when we were Fisher Body, this place was a family. And they always looked out for one another. You were always, there was no white, there was no black, there was no, none of this racial stuff in here. You were a family in here. And everybody's treated that way. Everybody looked out for one another. It was, you enjoyed working here because it had that atmosphere here. Even though the hours may be long and it may be rough, I met a man in here in 1973. And he's my partner today in the construction business. And I consider him as much my brother as one of my brothers. Mm-hmm. We've been very close, and he's a hell of a good man. One of the best. One of the things that I'll take out of my years at Fisher Body was having this man as a friend. So anybody can say that about where they work, I think it's saying something good about where they worked. Mm-hmm. But I still feel that once Oldsmobile took this place over, it quit becoming Fisher Body, and it lost the identity we had as being a close unit. Because when Olds come over here, it just completely, I think their main aim was to go in and destroy the culture, just the way the people felt about one another in here. They figured it was better for the business. Well, in my opinion, it's one of the worst things they could have done. Because mm-hmm. this place has never been the same. You never saw the camaraderie. The backstabbing, the fighting started, the politics come in, which is something you never had here before. And it just changed with them coming in. And I never saw it get any better up until the time I retired because of that reason.
Were you ever Cheryl McQuaid? Were you ever
No, I was never Cheryl McQuaid.
Were you ever a part of the union?
Yes. In 1983, I started out as being an alternate. When the district or the alternate wasn't there, I would fill in. I did that to see if it's something I wanted to do because I have always liked people. I've always liked being around people. And I've always liked helping people. So this was my way of seeing if it's something I really wanted to get involved in. And it did. I started out as alternate. I went to alternate. From there, I went to committee. From committee, I didn't last very long as a committeeman because it don't pay to be honest to be a committeeman. It comes back and bites you in the butt. So I just wasn't going to change my ways, and I wasn't going to lie to people. So it's best I got beat. I think it's one of the best things that ever happened to me was to get beat. At that point, I kind of dropped out for a little while. Then they started having union awareness classes. And I started, and a couple people come up and asked me if I would consider teaching them. So I told them, yeah, I'd give it a try. So I went in with, I'm trying to remember who all was. Hazel Hodge was in it. Myself was in. Deb McNichols. Winston Travis. And there was one other individual, and I can't remember his name. But we all started training on it. And we started, and they had us training with some supervisors, which didn't go good with me because I'd flat call them liars right to their face, and we'd have at it in the meetings, and I didn't think I was going to last very long. Well, then they each give us a presentation we were supposed to put on in front of the shop committee and some of the higher-ups in management. So we put the presentation on, and management give us scripted presentations to put on. And everybody put theirs on, and I ripped mine up. And I put on my own presentation, telling them what I thought about the program, what I thought about the way it was being orchestrated. And I figured that pretty well shot me down as an instructor. But when it got all done, the union says either he instructs or we don't have any program. So I wound up being one of the instructors. And it was one of the best things that ever happened to me because it was one of the things I enjoyed doing more than anything I ever did in this place was teaching about union awareness, about the history of the union, trying to tell people what their rights were, trying to tell them don't back down, don't be afraid to stand up if you think you're right. And I enjoyed doing it, and it lasted, gosh, I think a couple years. And at that point, I decided to run for education chairman. And I won that election, and I was on education chair and taught for, I think, 2 years after that, different classes the union itself put on. This wasn't management funded at that time. It was regular union classes. And I taught those, and like I said, that was the most enjoyable time I ever had in the union. And at Fisher Body, was teaching those classes. They were fun. The people were fun. They were fun to deal with, and we had a good time. After that, I went back on the line. They discontinued the program, so I went back on the line, was working. In that time, I was in repair and trim, working repair and enjoying that. And then I heard Bill White was going to retire as the workers' comp rep. And I had a couple guys come up and talk to me and ask me to consider running for it because the classes I taught and everything else. And they said, well, you're a people person. You like dealing with people. We need somebody over there who's not afraid to take management on or the union on to tell people what they can do. So I ran for it and got it. And the last 7.5 years I spent there, I spent as the workers' comp rep. It's kind of been my union.
Marilyn Cole, Jerry, can you please explain to us what a workers' comp rep does? What were some of the things you did?
Basically, what I did as a workers' comp rep is somebody would get, well, I was workers' compensation and unemployment chairman. So if we had a layoff coming up, if we had somebody who was laid off or whatever, where unemployment was involved, I got them set up with the unemployment. I'd go meet with the people on unemployment and get all our paperwork around, try and get everything. And this is something I implemented, and I think Harold's still continuing it today, is I would go meet with MESC, find out what we were going to do, make sure the paperwork was there, try and get the paperwork to people in the plant. I went through and met with the different groups in the plant, letting them know what was going on, what they had to do, who they had to talk to, make sure they knew to come over and see me, and we'd get things going. And so that was on the unemployment. On the workers' comp, it took me a year and a half to actually, because the guy who was there before me got pissed at the financial secretary of the union, walked out, just left me hanging. So I had to learn that job from the ground up. I had no training, no whatsoever. And this is where I will always be indebted to Larry Cackley and Neil Walensky, because they took the time. Those guys are the ones that actually trained me on the comp job. And they took the time that if I had any question, no matter where they were at, no matter what they were doing, if I called them, they called me.
Now, were they union people also?
They were attorneys that the union had dealt with prior to me being there. And like I could say, I can do nothing but praise them, because I couldn't have done half the job I did as a comp rep without the training those guys gave me going into it.
So now, as a workers' comp rep, did you only service your members? Did you have to service the families too?
The attitude that the guy before me had was that you served the members, and any UAW was his. My philosophy was I was there to serve the membership. Now, to me, that meant the members and their families. And I never turned down, to my knowledge, I never turned down talking to any UAW person that ever came through that door to talk to me. And I get calls from local presidents from Howell to Hastings asking me questions about what they should do on this or that or unemployment, or if they have a question. They called, and I always made sure I got them the information, learning the comp job. The one thing I found on the comp job, and the one thing I prided myself in the 7.5 years I was there, was the fact that whenever somebody called me, I always returned their phone call. To my knowledge, I never missed calling somebody back who called or left a message for me. And there's times when I've come back to my office and had 38 messages on my desk maybe an hour before it was time to close up the union hall, and I would still stay at the union hall until I made every one of those phone calls. Because that was something that was very important to me. Because the one thing I heard as a union rep and different union jobs is the union never gets back with me. I never hear back from them. I don't know what's going on. So the one thing I tried to do was to make the people know that they had a place where they could go and they could tell me something and know they weren't just talking to a wall. And I tried to be as honest with them as possible. And I've had times where people come into that office just screaming mad at me for what I told them. But my philosophy and what I would tell them after they got done ranting and raving, I'd say, you done? And they kind of calmed down. I said, listen, you want me to tell you the truth? Or you want me to tell you a lie that makes you feel good? And then down the road, find out that I lied to you. How much more pissed are you going to be when you come back and see me? If you know what the truth is, you know what you got to do to try and rectify a situation or where you stand. Rather than give you a bunch of BS to make you feel good, that's not doing you any good. That was the philosophy I had in that office. And I think it stood me well because I never heard anybody in my years there, and I'm not saying this to brag, but I'm saying it because I think I proved a point that if you're honest with the people, if you get back with the people, even if they don't want to hear what you're going to tell them, they at least respect you because you did get back with them and you did tell them. So they knew what they had to do from that point. So, I mean, that was my philosophy as a union rep, anyway.
Mike Fleming, Jerry. Unemployment cop and rep, when you were there, how was your relationship with the benefits people? How well did you all work together? And talk about the benefits representatives.
The benefits people I had, Gary McDaniels, Dan Daly, when I first come on with benefits rep, Sam Hall. I got along good with Gary McDaniels. I got along good with Dan Daly. I didn't get along with Sam Hall because I found she had her nose in my business giving people wrong information. I didn't buy that. And there was times when I would do the benefits jobs work. I didn't want to, but I didn't have a choice because they were holding on something. They were dragging on something. And these people needed pay. Well, I was able to get through, and if I could fax something down to them, I could get people their pay. Because that was the main thing. It's what fascinated me. I'm going to sidestep a minute. But what has always fascinated me about our plant is the kind of wages the people earn, the benefits that people have. And there's so many people in that plant that live check to check after 20 years. And they come in and, you know, they're going to shut my water off next week. You've only been off work a week. How the hell are they going to shut your water off next week? You ain't missed a check up until just now. They're going to shut it off. You know, this routine, and you knew a bunch of them were pulling your leg. You knew they weren't telling you the truth, but all you had to do was call around. We never got any paperwork. So where's your paperwork? Nobody told me I had to call in for any. So sometimes the benefits reps wouldn't tell them. You got to call in for your paperwork. They thought it was automatically sent to them. Either they didn't contact the rep or whatever the case, I don't know. But and Sam would get mad at me because I had some spare copies of the benefits. And I'd say, fill this out. They'd fill the thing out, get it to your doctor and get it back to me. I'll get it faxed in for you. Go to Marilyn upstairs. She'd fax paperwork in. Chances are I could get the guys the money within a week. It's just, you know, I would do that. I had that latitude. But that's one thing that always pissed Sam off, because I would do that. And she would accuse me of being stepping on her toes. And I had people who, more than once, I'd tell her, you know, I need this extension sent in. I need this paperwork sent in. And she'd come over and say, well, I really don't think they deserve it. And I'd say, well, that's not your call to make. And more than once, I threatened to throw her out of my office with the door open or closed. I was going to throw her out. She pissed me off that bad. But she went right up to Gary Burnett a couple times, wanted me taken off, wanted me fired, wanted me this, that, and the other thing. And Gary told her, he says, well, there's a lot of people I wouldn't mind taking on, but Jerry isn't one of them. So we just had, and when I signed up to retire, I figured she'd personally walk my paperwork through to get rid of me. As much as she disliked me, she stuck my paperwork in a drawer and wouldn't send it in and kept it there. So I wound up working a month and a half longer than I planned on, because she stuffed my paperwork and it never went through.
Jerry, Mike Fleming again. I just very briefly explain what a benefits rep does versus what you do, because you did give a very good of what happened there, but we don't know
what the benefits rep, they're contractually we have benefits. And these reps are there to see that the people are represented right as far as getting what they're entitled to under the benefits, under our agreement. As a workers' comp rep, I'm elected by the membership. The benefits reps are appointed by the international or whoever. I was elected by the membership to do my job, and my job entitled two state laws, workers' compensation and unemployment. And one thing that a lot of people didn't understand, and one thing I tried to enlighten them to when they come in, was everybody thought that workers' comp was workers' comp the same wherever you went. Every state in the United States has their own workers' comp law. And so the main reason why a lot of people come to Michigan and they would file workers' comp is workers' comp was one of the highest paying in Michigan as in the country. Only Ohio, New York, and I think California paid a higher comp rate than Michigan did. So a lot of people come to Michigan to file for comp. And that's another problem we had with a comp in the state. So I hope that answered, Mike, what the difference is in the two.
Thank you.
Okay.
Cheryl McCoy. Jerry, could you tell us a little bit about your workers' comp position and some of the things that you saw go on in the plant?
Well, there's, I guess, what you call stigma about factory workers, and about, especially for some reason, GM's had a good way of putting it out about their factory workers being nothing but lazy bums who come in there just so they can get out and draw comp and sit on their butt. It's a bad rap that our people have got. What we've got going on now, and you hear about it in the news, especially I heard about it just a couple weeks ago in the news, the biggest problem we have is repetitive motion injuries. And it's just right now they're finally realizing what we've been realizing. Anybody that deals with comp on my side of it has been realizing that it's there. It's a continuous problem. It's one that General Motors would never recognize, would never say what happened in their plants. Their idea of taking care of the problem was to move somebody over to a different job. Well, if they've got the injury, moving to a different job doesn't cure the injury. When I dealt with Gary Allen, the different people, when they used to have comp reps here for General Motors right in Lansing that I could deal with before they outsourced it out to whatever the name of the company is now doing it.
Secure.
Yeah. And when I dealt with Gary Allen, there's many times I'd go over to him with a case, and he would look at me and say, you know this guy's playing us. You know there's nothing wrong with him. You know there's playing games. How can you come in, keep a straight face, and want us to do everything with him? At that point, I'd put 10 more files down in front of him. I said, because of these other 10 right here that you know damn well were hurt in there, that you know will never be back again, but you do nothing but screw them over. Make them feel like dirt. Do everything you can to demean them when you know they were injured in there. So how can you sit there with a straight face and talk to me about one when there's 10 of them over here you're playing with? You take the good, you take the bad, same as I do. And so we kind of had an understanding. But I was able to get a lot of stuff done when they had somebody in-house that I could deal with. A lot of cases we didn't have to go to litigation on. A lot of them, if a person was off for a short period of time, I could get the thing done where I could get them some money. They wouldn't get all their money, but it saved them the attorney fees and everything else, and I could still give them a chunk of their money and get stuff taken care of.
So, not to interrupt you, so litigation, you're saying that you had to go to court with these people?
Oh, yes. That was quite common. And it was actually... It was a workers' comp bureau. Under the state law, there's a bureau set up that you had to go in front of, and there was magistrates there who would determine if you had a valid case or if you didn't. Mm-hmm. These magistrates are appointed by the governor. And lately, under the John Engler era, we had some of the worst magistrates, some of the far-right magistrates, not middle of the road, which we were dealing with most of the time. And it made it rough to win a case, even though we knew we had a good case. And these magistrates, I've heard one more than once when the doors were closed and the case was done say, I feel bad about it, but and they knew that they'd ruled the wrong way. But what are you going to do? You can't prove it. So the problem in the plant is repetitive motion. It's happened more times than I can count. Management's aware of it, and they tried to bring people in to address the problem, but they've never really addressed it. Anything management's ever brought into that plant, QWL. I mean, you go through the different things that we've been through over the years. Maybe you folks can think of some I'm not thinking of. But every time they have these organizations, they take the principle, they take the part of it that suits them, and don't do the whole thing.
What was QWL do?
Quality of work life. It's supposed to be where they come in, we work together, made things happen better. Well, they took the part of QWL where you worked with management. But when it comes to management's part of QWL working with you, that we didn't have time for that. We just want you to do what we think is best out of this. And there have been other things in there besides QWL. been out of there a while, so I can't remember. Maybe you can think of some.
First time build,
another good one. You know, it's we'll take the part of the process that benefits us, but we won't take the whole process because we really don't think this is necessary. When you have a concept, you should use the whole concept or not at all. Their idea has always been, we'll use the part of the concept we like that benefits us, but if this doesn't benefit us, we really don't need it. We don't need to pursue it. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the problem we've had is the union leaders we've had for the last 15 years have rolled right along with management.
Mike Fleming. So I guess, would it be safe to say that what you have seen in your time is that the policies and whatnot that come through General Motors mostly benefit the company, and very few, such as ergonomics or any type of standards that regulate how an employee gets resolves an issue of physical harm in there. Would you say that's more company-oriented or more employee-oriented?
The ergonomics policy that they first started while I was in there was a great concept. It was a great policy. But the company only used the part of ergonomics that says that if we do this with a person, that should be good enough. Not that if we do this and it doesn't work, then we have to go to a different remedy. They forget about the different remedy part. They use the part as, well, we can do this, as they interpret it. So it's always been, you know, we're bringing a policy in and we'll show the media, we'll show the world that we're really looking to help our workers. We're working to help our profit margin. Workers is a secondary thing. If we can get them out the door, buy them out, get rid of them, put them on something else. I'll give you a prime example. I wasn't ever in national negotiations, but I've sat through a bunch of meetings where they did have negotiations. They talk about negotiations, con, and different things like that. And one of the things with this jobs bank is a prime example. The jobs bank was brought in, the purpose of the jobs bank when it was negotiated was to force General Motors to bring work in-house for people rather than ship jobs overseas, ship jobs to Mexico, ship jobs out, to bring work in-house to keep these people working. But General Motors used it in a different way. Rather than do it to try and bring work in, they did it to do nothing but besmirch the union as to, well, look at these people. We got them sitting on their ass in the cafeteria, drawing $8 pay, and not doing anything. In other words, not shame on us because we can't find work for them or we won't bring work in-house for them, but shame on the union. Look what they negotiated. Look at the money it's costing us. I mean, this is the way the thing is spun over the years. So you get one person saying one thing, one person saying another. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I hate to sound like I'm a devout union man, but after what I've seen in there, after 30 years of watching General Motors be mismanaged and shot down the toilet the way they have been, it's kind of hard for me to be gung-ho and support GM when I've seen what they've done to the workers and to the corporation. I mean, from Roger B. Smith on down. What we've seen here, and there's some work in that plant that I believe won't agree with me, that was in there the last 30 years. We've seen the mismanagement and the complete stupidity of management over 30 years, and you kind of wonder why GM... You know, the saying has always been in the plant that General Motors will never go under. It's too big a corporation. But I think they're proving us wrong. Their stupidity is finally coming to the front, and they're going to prove us wrong. I'm sorry to say.
Yes, Jerry, we are going through some difficult times as a corporation. We're certainly going to be a smaller company as we go forward. When you were working in the plant, we had a lot of name changes that had taken place. We went from LCA, BOC, to, maybe another one or two. What do you refer to this plant as? Which name stuck with you the most?
This plant will always be Fisher Body to me. It was Fisher Body when I come here, and it'll be Fisher Body till the day I die. Rather standing or not, I'll always remember as Fisher Body. And this used to be a great place to work until Oldsmobile took it over. When it became BOC at that time, I think. Mm-hmm. It quit being Fisher Body in name, but anybody that hired in there when it was Fisher Body and knew what it was like when it was Fisher Body, it'll always be Fisher Body. It'll never change.
Jerry, during the time, Maryland Culture, during the time that you worked there, Lansing was referred to as the capital of quality. There were people who bought vehicles because they knew it was made in Lansing.
That's a fact.
What do you think it was? What do you think attributed? What made it special? What made Lansing special?
The quality that we built. The quality that we, back when this was Fisher Body, back in the early 80s even, when we were building the Cutlass in here, that was a car that was demanded all over the country. And there are people, I've talked to different people when I was in California, when I was in the service, I talked to people. And one guy says, I'm waiting for my new car. I said, well, where's it coming from? He says, well, it's, he says, I ordered an Oldsmobile, and he says, and it better be from Lansing. He said, I'm looking under the hood as soon as I get it. And it better have that Lansing mark on the VIN number to let me know it's at Lansing. He says, I'm sending it back. He said, the last one I had is the greatest car I ever owned. And I've talked to a lot of people, and they bought Lansing, and same with the 88s and 98s when they were built up here. They were demanded throughout the country because of the quality it was built in. The people took pride in what we built. But when General Motors combined it with Oldsmobile and it became BOC or whatever, you realize that General Motors was doing nothing but looking at the bucks. They weren't cared. They could talk about quality all they wanted, but we saw their concern for quality go right out the door. Their concern was profit margin, not quality. And until General Motors starts showing the workers that their concern is quality, not profit margin, I don't think the workers will ever have the attitude that we had when I first hired in here about turning out the quality that was here.
Jerry, when we talk about workers, you know, there are some people who have some misconceptions or some, we don't even call them stereotypes about workers. What were some of those things that once you became in there and you got involved with the people that you found that really weren't true?
A lot of it was, to me, I'd never been around African Americans that much. Now, this is a prime example. I'd never been around that many. Living in Shalott, it was not, you know, an area where very many were there. There was two that lived by me as I was a young kid growing up, two of the sweetest people I ever met in my life. I loved them to death. But I got to know the different cultures, the different people. Actually, even from the South, you want to call them hillbillies or whatever, but I mean, I got to talk to different people from different walks of life, and that's one thing that I've always enjoyed about the plant, about my union involvement. It's the different people I got to talk to, I got to know.
So it helped you in your own personal growth?
Very much so.
And did you find, whether you were the education chair, what about the education level on the floor? Were there people that were educated?
Compared to when I first come in there, you didn't need an education of any time to get in there. If you could read, sign your name, you come in. But I know, I worked with people in there who had teaching degrees that actually felt it was better to work in there than it was to be a teacher. So, yes, the level of education in that plant right now compared to was when I come in there in 68 is unbelievable. There's a lot more education there, and it's a shame General Motors doesn't use it. They have a ton of potential in there if they would just take the time to use it.
Now, you worked in there, you hired in 1968, and you retired 8 years ago. And now the place, Fisher Body, that you worked at, grew in, or helped workers, it's closed, and they're getting ready to tear the building down. How do you feel about that?
Sad. I hate to see it go. It's progress, I guess. It's going to happen. But as long as I got the memories, even though the building's gone, as long as I'm alive and got the memories, it'll still be there.
Okay. And
and the friendships and the people I've met over the years. That's important, too.
You were an education chair and a workers' comp chair. For the young people who might be coming into the labor force, into manufacturing, into the union, if you were teaching a class right now, what would you tell them? What do they need to do to make it happen?
I think the one thing I'd tell them more than anything else is look back in history. History has a way of repeating itself. We've seen it happen time and time again, and I think history is going to repeat itself some more. But the people today, there's always got to be a union movement. You know, even though the majority of the country right now seems to think it's not important, it's very important. Because if people don't look out for people, nobody else is going to. The government is so vast and so spread out that it can't be individual. It can't work for individuals. The individual has to work for themselves. And the individual can work for themselves a whole lot better if they work within a group who cares about everyone. And I think with the union, you've got that. If they keep the politics out of the union and keep the union where it does concern about the people, That is the biggest problem with our union is the politics. If the powers to be ever get it through their heads to get rid of the politics and concern about the people and the other unions, not just the UAW, but other unions too, if they forget about the politics, forget about the power struggle, and concentrate on caring for the members, I think you'll see a lot more people willing to join something they see as something who really concerned about the people, not concerned about the politics to get where they're at.
And one other thing before I turn it back over to Cheryl is, when you, a little bit ago, you told us CONCON. What is CONCON?
Constitutional Convention. Before they go to contract, they have a constitutional convention, and there's members that are voted on in the plant. Now, you put your name in as running for it, and then the members vote to send a number of delegates by, it's determined by the number of people in the plant. And a couple guys talked me into running for it once, so I put my name in and I got it, and it was a great experience. I really enjoyed going out. I learned a lot.
So this is UAW.
UAW, Constitutional. And the first one was held in San Diego, California. And I went, but the biggest problem is I hate flying. Mm-hmm. But I went anyway. And then 3 years later, a guy dared me to put my name in. I told him I'd put my name in, but I wasn't going to run for it. I wasn't going to campaign. So I threw my name in. I wound up going anyway. So I went to two of them, and I was fortunate. And that's where I really learned about the politics of the union. And I always have been bitter since going there for the simple fact that the politics that are involved there, you don't have a clear voice. The Constitution part of our government is, or our union is ran from the top down, not by the bottom up. You're not recognized. Until the union get to where it's one person, one vote within the union to lead the membership, versus the guys at CONCON electing who's already been designated to go, it's not going to change. And that's where a lot of dissenters. When I was at the last CONCON, which was back in 89 or 90, Jim Rainey come up. He was the assistant regional director. Come up, and we were sitting at our table. And other Lansing unions, I noticed, you know, whenever things were on, they were playing golf or going here, going there. That's one thing I will say for our union I'm proud of, is when we had Constitutional Convention, our people were always at the table, always in attendance, and always there to vote.
602.
And that's one thing I'm very proud of our group for doing. But Jim Ramey come up, handed me a towel, and handed me a piece of paper, and he says, when Bieber comes up, we want you to wave the towel and you'll be recognized, and we want you to talk on this subject. I looked at it and I says, I'm not going to do that. He said, why not? I said, because I don't believe in it. I'm not voting for it. And he said, oh, yes, you are. And I said, oh, no, I'm not. I said, I'll wave the towel, but if I stand up, I'm going to tell you what I think about this. And he said, do you know who you're talking to? I said, yeah, I know who I'm talking to. But I said, there's something you need to understand about me. And I said, it's one thing I've always felt. I said, you're not my boss. And at the time, Reuben Burks was our regional director. I said, he's not my boss. Mm-hmm. I pointed to Ted Hartman and to Dick Bennett, and I said, those guys aren't my boss. Mm-hmm. I said, that tall drink of water talking at the podium right now ain't my boss. Mm-hmm. I said, my boss is 5,000 people in that plant, and I'm going to do what I think is right for them. If you got a problem with that, I don't know what the hell to tell you. He turned around, walked away, and he never talked to me after that. But that was the attitude I had, and I wish more union people would get that attitude, the ones in the union position. Quit letting the union be run from the top down and get the union run from the bottom up like it's supposed to be, and I think the union can turn itself around.
Very good, Jerry. Cheryl, go ahead.
Michael. Jerry, is there, this is Cheryl McCoy, is there anything that you would like to share with us that we've not touched on?
Not really. It's good to see you. It's good to talk to you again. I miss the people. I don't miss management. I don't really miss the factory in a way, other than I hate to see it be tore down. But I miss the people. I've sure had a lot of fun with a lot of people over the years.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you for the interview. Thank you for your help. Thank you for your service.
Yes, no problem. Thank you for your time.
Glad to do it. I had fun.